here to Mass every single Sunday, and it's always good to take a step back and consider what's our motivation for going to Mass. Why do we go to Mass? And we can look at it, and I mentioned this before, as you know, this is a duty that we owe to God, the worship that we owe to God. And that's the traditional definition of religion. And that is legit, and that is valid, but often what that's reduced to is kind of like, I got to pay my spiritual taxes to God, right? So it's something I do, but I kind of do it begrudgingly. I have to give over some of my time and my talent, my treasure to make that happen. So let's maybe look a little bit or take another vantage point when it comes to our motivation and why do we go to Mass? Why do we go to Mass every single Sunday? Because the heart of the Christian life is about conversion. Growing in our relationship with God, growing in the life of the church. And so, as Pope Francis states in his document on the new evangelization, he says that this conversion is something that has to happen every single day. So people give conversion stories. A lot of times they highlight like one impactful moment in their life. Well, what we believe is like, yeah, there could be those kind of impactful moments, you know, where you're knocked off your horse. But what we're challenged and invited to, and what's actually more important, is that a conversion is happening every single day. So we're encountering Christ anew every single day. So let's go into this life of discipleship in which we're called to deeper and deeper and continuous conversion. With anything in life, a thing is always created twice. Before you take out the hammer and nails and put the boards together to build something, it has to be conceived and built in your mind first, right? So first we have a blueprint. First we have a plan. And then we go and apply the plan and make it a concrete reality in this physical world. So I have plans for the basement, okay? And they're written out in diagram. And then I go, I get the materials, and I build the basement. The same thing has to happen with the spiritual life. And sometimes we overlook the importance of first coming up with a plan and having an understanding of what the Christian life looks like. Because the tendency, as far as in my experience in our day and age, is to look at the Christian life as an individual pursuit. Okay, so it's something that I do. It's an individual sport, you might say, versus a team sport, like golf. Well, golf, I guess in high school, you can be on a team, right? And the team can go to state, whatever. But most of the time you think about golf, it's an individual sport. Well, is that the way that the Christian life and discipleship works? Well, actually, Christianity is more of a team sport. And that's why we identify ourselves as members of a church. And what baptism does, it doesn't just make us holy, it makes us members of a church, a community of people, the people of God. And so, a team sport. What does that mean? Well, it's kind of like we can't just be focused on ourselves, that it's a communal effort, and success depends upon how the community and how all of us do together. It's kind of like the basketball player who said, you know, I scored 50 points last night, but we lost, you know, but I scored 50 points. Well, that's great that you scored 50 points, but the goal is to win, right? And so when we look at the Christian life, do we look like how I'm doing, how many points I've scored, or are we looking about how the team's doing, right? So that's a paradigm shift, I think, right at the beginning as we're kind of putting out the blueprints for living out the Christian life and becoming holy. So in this second letter in the second reading, in Paul's letter to the people of God in Ephesus, he is addressing the community as basically the team, the people of God, and they are the ones that have to work together to live out the faith and to become one in faith, according to one God, one hope. You know, Paul goes through this list. And he says there's three primary behaviors that are necessary for this community, this team, to thrive. And what were those three behaviors? We might call virtues, right? Habitual, continuous behaviors. He says, he begins by saying, I'm a prisoner for the Lord, all right? So basically, everything about my life is for God and for Christ. And I urge you, brothers and sisters, to what? To humility, to gentleness, and to patience. So these are the three ecclesial or social virtues, behaviors that are necessary for our team to thrive. And if we're looking at a sport, is always against, includes an opponent, right? A team sport includes an opponent. Well, very much we have opponents that we're working against, the world, the flesh, and the devil as part of our tradition. So this is not just any kind of sport. This is the sport. And our eternal destiny is based upon the outcome of how we do. And so let's just take a couple minutes and reflect on these three virtues that we really need to drill down on and be intentional in living. Okay, so the first is humility. Now, the New Testament, the entire New Testament was written in English, right? No, Greek, okay? So we need to know a little bit of the Hellenistic or the Greek background of the words being used here. Because remember, whenever you introduce a translation, like you go from Spanish to English or whatever language you go to, you always lose something in the translation. All right, so let's fill it out a little bit. Well, the word humility that's rendered for us in English, in the Greek, humility was never used in a positive sense. So if the word humility was used in Greek, it was basically a person who was cowardly, who was a fool, who was inconsistent. It's never used in a positive and upbringing sense, which is interesting because what's the most important virtue in the Christian life? What have you heard since you were a little kid? Humility. So kind of turning the world on its head. And how do we define humility? Well, we've heard it described in many different ways, but humility, I think St. Bernard has one of the best definitions of humility. He says, it is the virtue, so the habitual behavior, the regular way of acting, by which a person becomes conscious of their own unworthiness in consequence of the truest knowledge of himself. So it's not of me saying, I'm so unworthy, I'm horrible. A person becomes aware and conscious that they're not worthy because they see how weak they are and how dependent they are upon other people and upon God. And this often comes through our own sinfulness and our own weakness. So we have a true knowledge of ourselves. So humility is about truth. All right, so that's the first virtue that's necessary, behavior that's necessary for a community that's going to thrive. The second virtue, the second behavior, is gentleness. Now this one needs a little bit of work because our understanding of gentle is just this really nice person who never gets upset or angry. They're so gentle. And we see that it's really virtuous. Well, the word gentle goes all the way back to Aristotle in the Greek, and he uses it in the context of talking about virtues. And for Aristotle, how he defined a virtue was the medium, the mean, the middle between two extremes. So you would have an excess and a defect. And so virtue was in the middle. Not too much, not too little. And so the Greek word for gentleness, that's translated gentleness for us, is the mean between being a person that's too angry and angry all the time and a person who's never angry. So interesting. To be a gentle person in the truest sense does mean that anger is a part of it at times. So it's in the middle, the right amount, at the right time, towards the right person. So gentleness is an essential virtue. Because, when we talk about anger is a kind of a defense mechanism and a recognizing that there's an injustice that has incurred. The third virtue, so we have humility, we have gentleness. And the third virtue for St. Paul to the church at Ephesus is patience. And the classic example, historic example, a Jewish writer around the time of Christ gives the example of the Roman soldier who never gives in. In a sense, his army is defeated, but he never gives up. He's long-suffering. I was thinking maybe kind of the example of the Japanese in World War II. Even if you defeated them, you never defeated them. I mean, like, they were going to never give up until they quit breathing, right? A person quits breathing. Well, that's what we mean by, that's the traditional understanding of patience as we receive it into our Christian tradition. So this incredible long-suffering. So if we want to grow in the life of holiness, be fuller disciples, that we would strive to live out our faith better as a team with the virtues of humility, gentleness, and patience. And I conclude with this. If you are intentional and deliberate about being a useful and important member of the team, you will not be able to achieve these virtues on your own. You will fail, undoubtedly fail. And that's why we hear in the opening prayer we heard, O God, who without you, we do not have a firm foundation, nor can we become holy. Without God, without the bread of life, without his strength, it's impossible. And so we ask the Holy Spirit to give us the dependence upon God, that we might live out these social virtues so as to overcome those temptations and evils that the world, the devil, and our flesh present.